The next day, Mikhail received another email. From Harriet.Wanger at wangerindustries.com to Mikhail.Blomqvist at millennium.se. Hi, Mikhail. I've been trying to find time to write to you for several weeks now, but it seems there are never enough hours in the day. You left so suddenly from Hedeby that I never had a chance to say goodbye. Since my return to Sweden, my days have been filled with bewildering impressions and hard work. The Wanger Corporation is in chaos, and along with Henrik, I've been working hard to put its affairs in order. Yesterday, I visited the Millennium offices. I'll be Henrik's representative on the board. Henrik has filled me in on all the details of the magazine's situation and yours. I hope that you will accept having me show up like this. If you don't want me or anyone else from the family on the board, I'll understand. But I do assure you that I'll do all I can to support Millennium. I am in great debt to you, and I will always have the best of intentions in this regard. I met your colleague, Erika Berger. I'm not sure what she thought of me, and I was surprised to hear that you hadn't told her about what happened. I would very much like to be your friend, if you can stand to have anything more to do with the Wanger family. Best regards, Harriet. P.S. I understood from Erika that you're planning to tackle Venestrom again. Dear Froda told me how Henrik pulled a swifty on you, as they say in Australia. What can I say? I'm sorry. If there's anything I can do, let me know. From Mikhail.Blomqvist at millennium.se to Harriet.Wanger at wangerindustries.com. Hi, Harriet. I left Hedeby in a big hurry and am now working on what I really should have been spending my time on this year. You will be advised in plenty of time before the article goes to press, but I think I can say that the problems of the past year will soon be over. I hope you and Erika will be friends, and of course I have no problem with you being on Millennium's board. I'll tell Erika about what happened, if you think that's wise. Henrik wanted me never to say anything to anyone. Let's see. But right now I don't have the time or the energy, and I need a little distance first. Let's keep in touch. Best, Mikhail. Salander was not especially interested in what Mikhail was writing. She looked up from her book when Blomqvist said something, but at first she could not make it out. Sorry, I was talking aloud. I said that this is horrible.
What's horrible?
Venestrom had an affair with a 22-year-old waitress and he got her pregnant. Have you read his correspondence with his lawyer?
My dear Mikhail, you have 10 years of correspondence, emails, agreements, travel arrangements, and God knows what on that hard drive. I don't find Venestrom so fascinating that I'd cram 6 gigs of garbage into my head. I read through a fraction of it mostly to satisfy my curiosity, and that was enough to tell me that he's a gangster.
Okay. He got her pregnant in 1997. When she wanted compensation, his lawyer got someone to try to convince her to have an abortion. I assume the intention was to offer her a sum of money, but she wasn't interested. Then the persuading ended up with a heavy holding her underwater in a bath until she agreed to leave Venestrom in peace. And Venestrom's idiot writes all this to the lawyer in an email. Of course encrypted, but even so. It doesn't say much for the IQ of this bunch.
What happened to the girl?
She had an abortion, and Venestrom was pleased. Salander said nothing for 10 minutes. Her eyes had suddenly turned dark.
One more man who hates women, she muttered at last.
She borrowed the CDs and spent the next few days reading through Venestrom's emails and other documents. While Blomqvist kept working, Salander was up in the sleeping loft with her power book on her knees pondering Venestrom's peculiar empire. An idea had occurred to her and she could not let it go. Most of all, she wondered why it had not occurred to her sooner. In late October, Mikhail turned off his computer when it was only 11 in the morning. He climbed up to the sleeping loft and handed Salander what he had written. Then he fell asleep. She woke him that evening and gave him her opinion of the article. Just after 2 in the morning, Blomqvist made the last backup of his work. The next day he closed the shutters on the windows and locked up. Salander's holiday was over. They went back to Stockholm together. He brought up the subject as they were drinking coffee from paper cups on the Vaxholm ferry. What the two of us need to decide is what to tell Erika. She's going to refuse to publish this if I can't explain how I got hold of the material. Erika Berger, Blomqvist's editor-in-chief and long-time lover. Salander had never met her and was not sure that she wanted to either.
Berger seemed like some indefinable disturbance in her life.
What does she know about me?
Nothing. He sighed. The fact is that I've been avoiding her ever since the summer. She's very frustrated about the fact that I couldn't tell her what happened in Hederstadt. She knows, of course, that I've been staying out at Sandhamn and writing this story, but she doesn't know what it's about.
Hmm.
In a couple of hours she'll have the manuscript. Then she's going to give me the third degree. The question is, what should I tell her?
What do you want to tell her?
I'd like to tell her the truth. Salander frowned. Lisbeth, Erica and I argue almost all the time. It seems to be part of how we communicate, but she's absolutely trustworthy. You're a source. She would rather die than reveal who you are.
How many others would you have to tell?
Absolutely no one. It will go to the grave with me and Erica. But I won't tell her your secret if you don't want me to. On the other hand, it's not an option for me to lie to Erica. Make up some source that doesn't exist. Salander thought about it until they docked by the Grand Hotel. Analysis of consequences. Reluctantly, she finally gave Blomqvist permission to introduce her to Erica. He switched on his mobile and made the call. Berger was lunching with Malin Eriksson, whom she was considering hiring as managing editor. Eriksson was 29 years old and had been working as a temp for 5 years. She had never held a permanent job and had started to doubt that she ever would. Berger called her on the very day that Malin's latest temp job ended to ask if she would like to apply for the Millennium position.
It's a temporary post for 3 months, Berger said, but if things work out, it could be permanent.
I've heard rumours that Millennium is having a difficult time,
Berger smiled. You shouldn't believe rumours.
This Dahlman that I would be replacing, Eriksson hesitated. He's going to work at a magazine owned by Hans Erik Wennerström.
Berger nodded. It's hardly a trade secret that we're in conflict with Wennerström. He doesn't like people who work for Millennium.
So if I take the job at Millennium, I would end up in that category too.
It's very likely, yes.
But Dahlman got a job with Monopoly Financial Magazine, didn't he?
You might say that it's Wennerström's way of paying for services rendered. Are you still interested?
Eriksson nodded.
When do you want me to start?
That's when Blomqvist called. She used her own key to open the door to his apartment. It was the first time since his brief visit to the office at Midsummer that she was meeting him face to face. She went into the living room and found an anorexically thin girl sitting on the sofa, wearing a worn leather jacket and with her feet propped up on the coffee table. At first, she thought the girl was about 15, but that was before she looked into her eyes. She was still looking at this creature when Blomqvist came in with a coffee pot and coffee cake.
"Forgive me for being completely impossible," he said.
Berger tilted her head. There was something different about him. He looked haggard, thinner than she remembered. His eyes had a shamed expression, and for a moment he avoided her gaze. She glanced at his neck. She saw a pale red line, clearly distinguishable.
"I've been avoiding you. It's a very long story, and I'm not proud of my role in it. But we'll talk about that later. Now I want to introduce you to this young woman. Erica, this is Lisbeth Salander. Lisbeth, Erica Berger, editor-in-chief of Millennium and my best friend."
Salander studied Berger's elegant clothes and self-confident manner and decided after 10 seconds that she was most likely not going to be her best friend. Their meeting lasted 5 hours. Berger twice made calls to cancel other meetings. She spent an hour reading parts of the manuscript that Blomqvist put in her hands. She had 1,000 questions, but realized that it would take weeks before she got them answered. The important thing was the manuscript, which she finally put down. If even a fraction of these claims were accurate, a whole new situation had emerged. Berger looked at Blomqvist. She had never doubted that he was an honest person, but now she felt dizzy and wondered whether the Wennerström affair had broken him, that what he had been working on was all a figment of his imagination. Blomqvist was at that moment unpacking 2 boxes of printed-out source material. Berger blanched. She wanted, of course, to know how it had come into his possession. It took a while to convince her that this odd girl, who had said not one word during the meeting, had unlimited access to Wennerström's computer. And not just his.
She had also hacked into the computers of several of his lawyers and close associates. Berger's immediate reaction was that they could not use the material, since it had been obtained through illegal means. But, of course, they could use it. Blomqvist pointed out that they had no obligation to explain how they had acquired the material. They could just as well have a source with access to Wennerström's computer, who had burned everything on his hard drive to a CD. Finally, Berger realized what a weapon she had in her hands. She felt exhausted and still had questions, but she did not know where to begin. At last, she leaned back against the sofa and threw out her hands.
Mikhail, what happened up in Hedestad?
Salander looked up sharply. Blomqvist answered with a question. How are you getting along with Harriet Wanger?
Fine, I think. I've met her twice. Prista and I drove up to Hedestad for a board meeting last week. We got drunk on wine.
And the board meeting?
She kept her word.
Ricky, I know you're frustrated that I've been ducking you and coming up with excuses not to tell you what happened. You and I have never had secrets from each other, and all of a sudden there's 6 months of my life that I'm not prepared to tell you about.
Berger met Blomqvist's gaze.
She knew him inside and out, but what she saw in his eyes was something she had never seen before. He was begging her not to ask. Salander watched their wordless dialogue. She was no part of it.
Was it that bad?
It was worse. I've been dreading this conversation. I promised to tell you, but I've spent several months suppressing my feelings while Wennerström has absorbed all my attention. I'm still not ready. I'd prefer it if Harriet told you instead.
What's that mark around your neck?
Lisbeth saved my life up there. If it weren't for her, I'd be dead.
Berger's eyes widened. She stared at the girl in the leather jacket.
And right now you need to come to an agreement with her. She is our source.
Berger sat for a time, thinking. Then she did something that astonished Blomqvist and startled Salander. She surprised even herself. The whole time she'd been sitting at Mikhail's living room table, she had felt Salander's eyes upon her. A taciturn girl with hostile vibrations. Berger stood up and went around the table and threw her arms around the girl. Salander squirmed like a worm about to be put on a hook.
Chapter 29. Saturday, November 1st to Tuesday, November 25th. Salander was surfing through Wennerström's cyber empire. She had been staring at her computer screen for almost 11 hours. The idea that had materialized in some unexplored nook of her brain during the last week at Sandhamn had grown into a manic preoccupation. For 4 weeks she had isolated herself in her apartment and ignored any communication from Armansky. She had spent 12 hours a day in front of her computer, some days more, and the rest of her waking hours she had brooded over the same problem. During the past month she had had intermittent contact with Blomqvist. He, too, was preoccupied, busy at the Millennium offices. They had conferred by telephone a couple of times each week, and she had kept him updated on Wennerström's correspondence and other activities. For the 100th time she went over every detail. She was not afraid that she had missed anything, but she was not sure that she had understood how every one of the intricate connections fitted together. This much-discussed empire was like a living, formless, pulsating organism that kept changing shape. It consisted of options, bonds, shares, partnerships, loan interest, income interest, deposits, bank accounts, payment transfers, and thousands of other elements. An incredibly large proportion of the assets was deposited in post office box companies that owned one another. The financial pundits' most inflated analyses of the Wennerström Group estimated its value at more than 900 billion kroner. That was a bluff, or at least a figure that was grossly exaggerated. Obviously, Wennerström himself was by no means poor. She calculated the real assets to be worth between 90 and 100 billion kroner, which was nothing to sneeze at. A thorough audit of the entire corporation would take years. All in all, Salander had identified close to 3,000 separate accounts and bank holdings all over the world. Wennerström was devoting himself to fraud that was so extensive it was no longer merely criminal, it was business. Somewhere in the Venestrom organism there was also substance. Three assets kept showing up in the hierarchy. The fixed Swedish assets were unassailable and genuine, available to public scrutiny, balance sheets, and audits. The American firm was solid, and a bank in New York served as the base for all liquid capital. The story was in the business with the post office box companies in places such as Gibraltar and Cyprus and Macau. Venestrom was like a clearinghouse for the illegal weapons trade, money laundering for suspect enterprises in Colombia, and extremely unorthodox businesses in Russia. An anonymous account in the Cayman Islands was unique. It was personally controlled by Venestrom, but was not connected to any companies. A few hundredths of a percent of every deal that Venestrom made would be siphoned into the Cayman Islands via the post office box companies. Salander worked in a trance-like state. The account, click. Email, click. Balance sheets, click. She noted down the latest transfers. She tracked a small transaction in Japan to Singapore and on via Luxembourg to the Cayman Islands. She understood how it worked. It was as if she were part of the impulses in cyberspace. Small changes, the latest email. One brief message of somewhat peripheral interest was sent at 10 p.m. The PGP encryption program, Rattle Rattle, was a joke for anyone who was already inside his computer and could read the message in plain text. Berger has stopped arguing about the ads. Has she given up or does she have something cooking? Your source at the editorial offices assured us that they were on the brink of ruin, but it sounds as if they just hired a new person. Find out what's happening. Blomqvist has been working at Sandhamn for the past few weeks, but no one knows what he's writing. He's been seen at the editorial offices the past few days. Can you arrange for an advance copy of the next issue? H.E.W. Nothing dramatic. Let him worry. Your goose is cooked, old man. At 5:30 in the morning, she turned off her computer and got out a new pack of cigarettes. She had drunk five Cokes during the night, and now she got out a sixth and went to sit on the sofa. She was wearing only knickers and a washed-out camouflage shirt advertising Soldier of Fortune magazine with the slogan, "Kill them all and let God sort them out." She realized that she was cold, so she reached for a blanket which she wrapped around herself. She felt high, as if she had consumed some inappropriate and presumably illegal substance. She focused her gaze on the street lamp outside the window and sat still while her brain worked at top speed. Mama, click. Sister, click. Mimi, click. Holger Palmgren, Evil Fingers, and Armansky, The Job, Harriet Wanger, click. Martin Wanger, click. The Golf Club, click. The Lawyer Bureman, click. Every single fucking detail that she couldn't forget, even if she tried. She wondered whether Bureman would ever take his clothes off in front of a woman again, and if he did, how was he going to explain the tattoos on his stomach? And the next time he went to the doctor, how would he avoid taking off his clothes? And Mikael Blomqvist, click. She considered him to be a good person, possibly with a practical pig complex that was sometimes a little too apparent, and he was unbearably naive with regard to certain elementary moral issues. He had an indulgent and forgiving personality that looked for explanations and excuses for the way people behaved, and he would never get it that the raptors of the world understood only one language. She felt almost awkwardly protective whenever she thought of him. She did not remember falling asleep, but she woke up at 9 a.m. with a crick in her neck and with her head leaning against the wall behind the sofa. She tottered to the bedroom and fell back to sleep. It was, without a doubt, the biggest story of their lives. For the first time in a year and a half, Berger was happy in the way that only an editor who has a spectacular scoop in the oven can be. She and Blomqvist were polishing the article one last time when Salander called him on his mobile. "I forgot to say that Venestrom is starting to get worried about what you've been doing lately, and he's asked for an advance copy of the next issue." "How do you know?" "Oh, forget that. Any idea what he plans to do?" "Nix. Just one logical guess." Blomqvist thought for a few seconds. "The printer," he exclaimed. Berger raised her eyebrows. "If you're keeping a lid on the editorial offices, there aren't many other possibilities, provided none of his thugs is planning to pay you a night-time visit." Blomqvist turned to Berger. "Book a new printer for this issue,"
Now, and call Dragan Armansky. I want security here at night for the next week.
Back to Salander.
Thanks.
What's it worth?
What do you mean?
What's the tip worth?
What would you like?
I'd like to discuss it over coffee. Right now.
They met at the cafe bar on Hornsgarten. Salander looked so serious when Blomqvist sat down on the bench next to her that he felt a pang of concern. As usual, she came straight to the point.
I need to borrow some money.
Blomqvist gave her one of his most foolish grins and reached for his wallet.
Sure. How much?
120,000 kroner.
Steady, steady.
He put his wallet away.
I'm not kidding. I need to borrow 120,000 kroner for, let's say, 6 weeks. I have a chance to make an investment, but I don't have anyone else to turn to. You've got roughly 140,000 kroner in your current account right now. You'll get your money back.
No point commenting on the fact that Salander had hacked his bank password.
You don't have to borrow the money from me, he replied. We haven't discussed your share yet, but it's more than enough to cover what you want to borrow.
My share?
Lisbeth. I have an insane fee to cash in from Henrik Wanger, and we're going to finalise the deal at the end of the year. Without you, there wouldn't be a me, and Millennium would have gone under. I'm planning to split the fee with you, 50-50.
Salander gave him a searching look. A frown had appeared on her brow. Blomqvist was used to her silences. Finally, she shook her head.
I don't want your money.
But I don't want one single kroner from you unless it comes in the form of presents on my birthday.
Come to think of it, I don't even know when your birthday is.
You're a journalist. Check it out.
I'm serious, Lisbeth, about splitting the money.
I'm serious too. I only want to borrow it and I need it tomorrow.
She didn't even ask how much her share would be. I'll be happy to go to the bank with you today and lend you the amount you need. But at the end of the year, let's have another talk about your share. He held up his hand. And by the way, when is your birthday?
On Valpurgis night, she replied. Very fitting, don't you think? That's when I gather round with a broom between my legs.
She landed in Zurich at 7:30 in the evening and took a taxi to the Matterhorn Hotel. She had booked a room under the name of Irene Nasser, and she identified herself using a Norwegian passport in that name. Irene Nasser had shoulder-length blonde hair. Salander had bought a wig in Stockholm and used 10,000 kroner of what she had borrowed from Blomqvist to buy two passports through one of the contacts in Plague's international network. She went to her room, locked the door and got undressed. She lay on the bed and looked up at the ceiling in the room that cost 1,600 kroner per night. She felt empty. She had already run through half the sum she'd borrowed, and even though she had added in every kroner of her own savings, she was still on a tight budget. She stopped thinking and fell asleep, almost at once. She awoke just after 5 in the morning. She showered and spent a long time masking the tattoo on her neck with a thick layer of skin-coloured lotion and powder over it. The second item on her checklist was to make an appointment at the beauty salon in the lobby of a significantly more expensive hotel for 6:30 that morning. She bought another blonde wig, this one in a pageboy style, and then she had a manicure, getting pink nails attached to her own chewed ones. She also got false eyelashes, more powder, rouge, and finally lipstick and other makeup. No change from 8,000 kroner. She paid with a credit card in the name of Monica Scholes, and she showed them her British passport with that name. Next stop was Camille's House of Fashion down the street. After an hour she came out wearing black boots, a sand-coloured skirt with matching blouse, black tights, a waist-length jacket and a beret. Every item bore an expensive designer label. She had let the salesgirl make the selection. She had also chosen an exclusive leather briefcase and a small Samsonite suitcase. The crowning touches were discreet earrings and a simple gold chain around her neck. The credit card had been debited 44,000 kroner. For the first time in her life, Salander had a bust line that made her, when she glanced at herself in the full-length mirror, catch her breath. The breasts were as fake as Monica Scholl's identity. They were made of latex and had been bought in Copenhagen, where the transvestites shopped. She was ready for battle. Just after 9, she walked 2 blocks to the venerable Zimmertal Hotel, where she booked a room in Monica Scholl's name. She gave a generous tip to a boy who carried up her suitcase, which contained her travel bag. The suite was a small one, costing 22,000 kroner a day. She had booked it for one night.
When she was alone, she took a look around. She had a dazzling view of Lake Zurich, which didn't interest her in the least, but she did spend close to 5 minutes examining herself in the mirror. She saw a total stranger. Big-busted Monica Scholes in a blonde pageboy wig, wearing more makeup than Lisbeth Salander dreamed of using in a whole month. She looked different. At 9:30, she had breakfast in the hotel bar, 2 cups of coffee and a bagel with jam. The cost was 210 kroner. Are these people soft in the head? Just before 10, Monica Scholes set down her coffee cup, opened her mobile and punched in the number of a modem uplink in Hawaii. After 3 rings, the hand-shaking tone began. The modem was connected. Monica Scholes replied by punching in a 6-digit code on her mobile and texting a message containing instructions to start a program that Salander had written especially for this purpose. In Honolulu, the program came to life on an anonymous home page on a server that was officially located at the university. The program was simple. Its only function was to send instructions to start another program in another server, which in this case was a perfectly ordinary commercial ISP offering internet services in Holland. The function of that program, in turn, was to look for the mirrored hard drive belonging to Hans Erik Wennerström and take command of the program that showed the contents of his approximately 3,000 bank accounts around the world. There was only one account of any interest. Salander had noted that Wennerström looked at the account a couple of times each week. If he turned on his computer and looked at that particular file, everything would appear to be normal. The program showed small changes, which were to be expected based on normal fluctuations in the account during the past 6 months. If during the next 48 hours, Wennerström should go in and ask to have the funds paid out or moved from the account, the program would dutifully report that it had been done. In reality, the change would have occurred only on the mirrored hard drive in Holland. Monica Scholes switched off her mobile the moment she heard 4 short tones, confirming that the program had started. She left the Zimmertal Hotel and walked over to Bankhauser General, across the street, where she had made an appointment to see Herr Wagner, the general manager, at 10. She was there 3 minutes ahead of schedule, and she spent the waiting time posing in front of the surveillance camera, which took her picture as she walked into the department with offices for discreet private consultations. "I need some assistance with a number of transactions," she said in Oxford English. When she opened her briefcase, she let drop a pen from the Zimmertal Hotel, and Herr Wagner politely retrieved it for her. She gave him an arch smile and wrote an account number on the notepad on the desk in front of her. Herr Wagner pigeonholed her as the spoiled daughter, or possibly mistress, of some big shot. "There are a number of accounts at the Bank of Kronenfeld in the Cayman Islands. Automatic transfer can be done by sequential clearing codes," she said.
"Fräulein Scholes, naturally you have all the required clearing codes?" he asked.
"Aber natürlich," she replied with such a heavy accent that it was obvious she had only school-level German. She started reciting several series of 16-digit numbers without once referring to any papers. Herr Wagner saw that it was going to be a long morning, but for a 4% commission on the transactions he was prepared to skip lunch, and he was going to have to revise his pigeonhole for Fräulein Scholes. She did not leave Bankhauser General until just past noon, slightly later than planned, and she walked back to the Zimmertal. She put in an appearance at the front desk before she went up to her room and took off the clothes she had bought. She kept on the latex breasts, but replaced the pageboy wig with Irene Ness's shoulder-length blonde hair. She put on more familiar clothes, boots with stiletto heels, black trousers, a simple shirt and a nice black leather jacket from Malungsborden in Stockholm. She studied herself in the mirror. Not unkempt, by any means, but she was no longer an heiress. Before Irene Nessa left the room, she sorted through a number of bonds, which she placed inside a thin portfolio. At 1:05, a few minutes behind schedule, she went into Bank Dorfmann, about 70 yards away from Bankhauser General. Irene Nessa had made an appointment in advance with a Herr Hasselmann. She apologized for being late. She spoke impeccable German, with a Norwegian accent.
"No problem at all, Fräulein," Herr Hasselmann said. "How can I be of service?"
"I would like to open an account. I have a number of private bonds that I'd like to convert."
Irene Nessa placed her portfolio on the desk in front of him. Herr Hasselmann examined the contents.
hastily at first and then more slowly. He raised an eyebrow and smiled politely. She opened 5 numbered accounts, which she could access via the internet and which were owned by an apparently anonymous post office box company in Gibraltar. A broker had set them up for her for 50,000 kroner of the money she had borrowed from Blomqvist. She cashed in 50 of the bonds and deposited the money in the accounts. Each bond was worth the equivalent of 1 million kroner. Her business at the Bank Dorfman also took more time than expected, so now she was even more behind on her schedule. She had no chance to take care of her final transactions before the banks closed for the day, so Irene Nessa returned to the Matterhorn Hotel, where she spent an hour hanging around to establish her presence. But she had a headache and went to bed early. She bought some aspirin at the front desk and ordered a wake-up call for 8 a.m. Then she went back to her room. It was close to 5 p.m. and all the banks in Europe were closed for business, but the banks in North and South America were open. She boosted up her powerbook and uplinked to the net through her mobile. She spent an hour emptying the numbered accounts she had opened at Bank Dorfman earlier in the day. She divided the money up into small amounts and used it to pay invoices for a large number of fictional companies around the world. When she was done, the money had strangely enough been transferred back to the Bank of Kronenfeld in the Cayman Islands, but this time to an entirely different account than the one from which it had been withdrawn earlier that day. Irene Nessa considered this first stage to be secure and almost impossible to trace. She made one payment from the account. The sum of nearly 1 million kroner was deposited into an account linked to a credit card that she had in her wallet. The account was owned by Wasp Enterprises, registered in Gibraltar. Several minutes later, a girl with blonde pageboy hair left the Matterhorn by a door into the hotel bar. Monica Scholes walked to the Zimmertal Hotel, nodded politely to the desk clerk, and took the lift up to her room. There she took her time putting on Monica Scholes' combat uniform, touching up her makeup and applying an extra layer of skin cream to the tattoo before she went down to the hotel restaurant and had an insanely delicious fish dinner. She ordered a bottle of vintage wine that she had never heard of before, though it cost 1,200 kroner, drank one glass and nonchalantly left the rest before she went into the hotel bar. She left absurd tips, which certainly made the staff notice her. She spent quite a while allowing herself to be picked up by a drunk young Italian with an aristocratic name which she did not bother to remember. They shared 2 bottles of champagne, of which she drank almost one glass. Around 11, her intoxicated suitor leaned forward and boldly squeezed her breast. She moved his hand down to the table, feeling pleased. He did not seem to have noticed that he was squeezing soft latex. At times they were so loud that they caused a certain amount of irritation among the other guests. Just before midnight, when Monica Scholes noticed that a hall porter was keeping a stern eye on them, she helped her Italian boyfriend up to his room. When he went to the bathroom, she poured one last glass of wine. She opened a folded piece of paper and spiked the wine with a crushed Rohypnol sleeping tablet. He passed out in a miserable heap on the bed within a minute after she drank a toast with him. She loosened his tie, pulled off his shoes, and drew a cover over him. She wiped the bottle clean, then washed the glasses in the bathroom and wiped them off too, before going back to her room. Monica Scholes had breakfast in her room at 6 and checked out of the Zimmertal at 6:55. Before leaving her room, she spent 5 minutes wiping off fingerprints from the door handles, wardrobes, toilet, telephone, and other objects in the room that she had touched. Irene Nessa checked out of the Matterhorn around 8:30, shortly after the wake-up call. She took a taxi and left her luggage in a locker at the railway station. Then she spent the next few hours visiting 9 private banks, where she distributed some of the private bonds from the Cayman Islands. By 3 in the afternoon, she had converted about 10% of the bonds into cash, which she deposited in 30 numbered accounts. The rest of the bonds she bundled up and put in a safe deposit box. Irene Nessa would need to make several more visits to Zurich, but there was no immediate hurry. At 4:30 that afternoon, Irene Nessa took a taxi to the airport, where she went into the ladies' room and cut up Monica Scholes' passport into little pieces, flushing them down the toilet. The credit card she also cut up and put the bits in 5 different rubbish bins, and the scissors too. After September 11th, it was not a good idea to attract attention by having any sharp objects in your baggage.
Irene Nesser took Lufthansa flight GD890 to Oslo and caught the airport bus to the Oslo train station, where she went into the ladies' room and sorted through her clothes. She placed all items belonging to the Monica Scholes persona, the pageboy wig and the designer clothes, in three plastic bags, and tossed them into three different rubbish containers and waste baskets in the train station. She put the empty Samsonite suitcase in an unlocked locker. The gold chain and earrings were designer jewellery that could be traced. They disappeared down a drain in the street outside the station. After a moment of anxious hesitation, Irene Nesser decided to keep the fake latex breasts. By then she did not have much time and took on some fuel in the form of a hamburger from McDonald's while she transferred the contents of the luxury leather briefcase to her travel bag. When she left, the empty briefcase remained under the table. She bought a latte to go at a kiosk and ran to catch the night train to Stockholm. She arrived as the doors were closing. She had booked a private sleeping berth. When she locked the door to her compartment, she could feel that for the first time in 2 days, her adrenaline levels had returned to normal. She opened the compartment window and defied the no-smoking regulations. She stood there sipping at her coffee as the train rolled out of Oslo. She ran through her checklist to be sure that she had forgotten no detail. After a moment, she frowned and rummaged through her jacket pockets. She took out the complimentary pen from the Zimmertal Hotel and studied it for several minutes before she tossed it out of the window. After 15 minutes, she crept into bed and fell asleep. Epilogue. Final Audit. Thursday, November 27th to Tuesday, December 30th. Millennium's special report on Hans Erik Wennerström took up all of 46 pages of the magazine and exploded like a time bomb the last week of November. The main story appeared under the joint byline of Mikael Blomqvist and Erika Berger. For the first few hours, the media did not know how to handle the scoop. A similar story just a year earlier had resulted in Blomqvist being convicted of libel, and it had also apparently resulted in his being dismissed from Millennium. For that reason, his credibility was regarded as rather low. Now the same magazine was back with a story by the same journalist containing much more serious allegations than the article for which he had run into so much trouble. Some parts of the report were so absurd that they defied common sense. The Swedish media sat and waited, filled with mistrust. But that evening, she, on TV4, led off with an 11-minute summary of the highlights in Blomqvist's accusations. Berger had lunched with the host several days earlier and given her an advance exclusive. TV4's brutal profile scooped the state-run news channels, which did not clamber onto the bandwagon until the 9 o'clock news. By then, the TT wire service had also sent out its first wire with the cautious headline, "Convicted Journalist Accuses Financier of Serious Crime." The text was a rewrite of the TV story, but the fact that TT addressed the subject at all unleashed feverish activity at the conservative morning newspaper and at a dozen of the larger regional papers as they reset their front pages before the presses started rolling. Up until then, the papers had more or less decided to ignore the Millennium allegations. The liberal morning newspaper commented on Millennium's scoop in the form of an editorial, written personally by the editor-in-chief earlier in the afternoon. The editor-in-chief then went to a dinner party as TV4 started broadcasting its news programme. He dismissed his secretary's frantic calls that there might be something to Blomqvist's claims with these later famous words.
"Nonsense. If there were, our financial reporters would have found out about it long ago."
Consequently, the liberal editor-in-chief's editorial was the only media voice in the country that butchered Millennium's claims. The editorial contained phrases such as "personal vendetta," "criminally sloppy journalism," and demands that measures be taken against indictable allegations regarding decent citizens. But that was the only contribution the editor-in-chief made during the debate. That night, the Millennium editorial offices were fully staffed. According to their plans, only Berger and the new managing editor, Malin Eriksson, were due to be there to handle any calls, but by 10 p.m. the entire staff was still there. And they had also been joined by no fewer than 4 former staff members and half a dozen regular freelancers. At midnight, Malm opened a bottle of champagne.
That was when an old acquaintance sent over an advance copy from one of the evening papers, which devoted 16 pages to the Venestrom affair under the headline, "The Financial Mafia." When the evening papers came out the next day, a media frenzy erupted, the likes of which had seldom been seen before. Erickson concluded that she was going to enjoy working at Millennium. During the following week, the Swedish Stock Exchange trembled as the securities fraud police began investigating. Prosecutors were called in and a panicky selling spree set in. 2 days after the publication, the Minister of Commerce made a statement on the Venestrom affair. The frenzy did not mean, however, that the media swallowed Millennium's claims without criticism. The revelations were far too serious for that. But unlike the first Venestrom affair, this time Millennium could present a convincing burden of proof. Venestrom's own emails and copies of the contents of his computer, which contained balance sheets from secret bank assets in the Cayman Islands and 24 other countries, secret agreements, and other blunders that a more cautious racketeer would never in his life have left on his hard drive. It soon became clear that if Millennium's claims held up in a court of appeals, and everyone agreed that the case would end up there sooner or later, that it was by far the biggest bubble to burst in the Swedish financial world since the Kreuger crash of 1932. The Venestrom affair made all the Gotabank imbroglios and Trustor frauds pale in comparison. This was fraud on such a grand scale that no one even dared to speculate on how many laws had been broken. For the first time in Swedish financial reporting, the terms organized crime, mafia, and gangster empire were used. Venestrom and his young stockbrokers, partners, and Armani-clad lawyers emerged like a band of hoodlums. During the first days of the media frenzy, Blomqvist was invisible. He did not answer his emails and could not be reached by telephone. All editorial comments on behalf of Millennium were made by Berger, who purred like a cat as she was interviewed by the Swedish national media and important regional newspapers, and eventually also by a growing number of overseas media. Each time she was asked how Millennium had come into possession of all those private and internal documents, she replied simply that she was unable to reveal the magazine's source. When she was asked why the previous year's exposé of Venestrom had been such a fiasco, she was even more Delphic. She never lied, but she may not always have told the whole truth. Off the record, when she did not have a microphone under her nose, she would utter a few mysterious catchphrases, which, if pieced together, led to some rather rash conclusions. That is how a rumour was born that soon assumed legendary proportions, claiming that Mikael Blomqvist had not presented any sort of defence at his trial and had voluntarily submitted to the prison sentence and heavy fines, because otherwise his documentation would have led inevitably to the identification of his source. He was compared to role models in the American media who had accepted jail rather than reveal their sources, and Blomqvist was described as a hero in such ludicrously flattering terms that he was quite embarrassed. But this was no time to deny the misunderstanding. There was one thing that everyone agreed on. The person who had delivered the documentation had to be someone within Venestrom's most trusted circle. This led to a debate about who the deep throat was. Colleagues with reason to be dissatisfied, lawyers, even Venestrom's cocaine-addicted daughter and other family members were put up as possible candidates. Neither Blomqvist nor Berger commented on the subject. Berger smiled happily, knowing that they had won when an evening paper on the third day of the frenzy ran the headline, "Millennium's Revenge." The article was an ingratiating portrait of the magazine and its staff, including illustrations with a particularly favourable portrait of Berger. She was named the Queen of Investigative Journalism. That sort of thing won points in the rankings of the entertainment pages, and there was talk of the Big Journalism Prize. 5 days after Millennium fired the first salvo, Blomqvist's book, The Mafia Banker, appeared in bookshops. The book had been written during those feverish days at Sandhamn in September and October, and in great haste and under the utmost secrecy, it was printed by Halviks Reklam in Morgengåva. It was the first book to be published under Millennium's own logo. It was eccentrically dedicated to Sally, who showed me the benefits of the sport of golf. It was a brick of a book, 608 pages in paperback. The first edition of 2,000 copies was virtually guaranteed to be a losing proposition, but the print run actually sold out in a couple of days, and Berger ordered 10,000 more copies. The reviewers concluded that this time, at any rate, Mikhail Blomkvist had no intention of holding back, since it was a matter of publishing extensive source references. In this regard, they were right. Two-thirds of the book consisted of appendices that were actual copies of the documentation from Wennerström's computer. At the same time as the book was published, Millennium put the texts from Wennerström's computer as source material in downloadable PDF files on their website. Blomkvist's extraordinary absence was part of the media strategy that he and Berger had put together. Every newspaper in the country was looking for him. Not until the book was launched did he give an exclusive interview to She on TV4, once again scooping the state-run stations. But the questions were anything but sycophantic. Blomkvist was especially pleased with one exchange when he watched a video of his appearance. The interview was broadcast live at the very moment when the Stockholm Stock Exchange found itself in free fall and a handful of financial yuppies were threatening to throw themselves out of windows. He was asked what was Millennium's responsibility with regard to the fact that Sweden's economy was now headed for a crash. "The idea that Sweden's economy is headed for a crash is nonsense," Blomkvist said. The host of She on TV4 looked perplexed. His reply did not follow the pattern she had expected, and she was forced to improvise. Blomkvist got the follow-up question he was hoping for. "We're experiencing the largest single drop in the history of the Swedish Stock Exchange, and you think that's nonsense?"
"You have to distinguish between two things, the Swedish economy and the Swedish stock market. The Swedish economy is the sum of all the goods and services that are produced in this country every day. There are telephones from Ericsson, cars from Volvo, chickens from Scan, and shipments from Kiruna to Skövde. That's the Swedish economy, and it's just as strong or weak today as it was a week ago."
He paused for effect and took a sip of water.
"The stock exchange is something very different. There is no economy and no production of goods and services. There are only fantasies in which people from one hour to the next decide that this or that company is worth so many billions more or less. It doesn't have a thing to do with reality or with the Swedish economy."
"So you're saying that it doesn't matter if the stock exchange drops like a rock?"
"No, it doesn't matter at all,"
Blomkvist said in a voice so weary and resigned that he sounded like some sort of oracle. His words would be quoted many times over the following year. Then he went on.
"It only means that a bunch of heavy speculators are now moving their shareholdings from Swedish companies to German ones. So it's the financial gnomes that some tough reporter should identify and expose as traitors. They're the ones who are systematically, and perhaps deliberately, damaging the Swedish economy in order to satisfy the profit interests of their clients."
Then She on TV4 made the mistake of asking exactly the question that Blomkvist had hoped for. "And so you think that the media don't have any responsibility?"
"Oh, yes. The media do have an enormous responsibility. For at least 20 years, many financial reporters have refrained from scrutinizing Hans-Erik Wennerström. On the contrary, they've actually helped to build up his prestige by publishing brainless, idolatrous portraits. If they had been doing their work properly, we would not find ourselves in this situation today."
Blomkvist's appearance marked a turning point. In hindsight, Berger was convinced that it was only when Blomkvist went on TV and calmly defended his claims that the Swedish media, in spite of the fact that Millennium had been all over the headlines for a week, recognized that the story really did hold up. His attitude set the course for the story. After the interview, the Wennerström affair imperceptibly slipped from the financial section over to the desks of the crime reporters. In the past, ordinary crime reporters had seldom or never written about financial crime, except if it had to do with the Russian mob or Yugoslav cigarette smugglers. Crime reporters were not expected to investigate intricate dealings on the stock exchange. One evening paper even took Blomkvist at his word and filled two spreads with portraits of several of the brokerage house's most important players who were in the process of buying up German securities. The paper's headline read, "Selling out their country." All the brokers were invited to comment on the allegations. Every one of them declined. But the trading of shares decreased significantly that day, and some brokers who wanted to look like progressive patriots started going against the stream. Blomkvist burst out laughing.
The pressure got to be so great that somber men in dark suits put on a concerned expression and broke with the most important rule of the exclusive club that made up the innermost circles of Swedish finance. They commented on a colleague. All of a sudden, retired industrial leaders and bank presidents were appearing on TV and answering questions in an attempt at damage control. Everyone realized the seriousness of the situation, and it was a matter of distancing themselves as quickly as possible from the Wennerström Group and shedding any shares they might hold. Wennerström, they concluded almost with one voice, was not, after all, a real industrialist, and he had never been truly accepted into the club. Some pointed out that he was just a simple working-class boy from Norrland, whose success may have gone to his head. Some described his actions as a personal tragedy. Others discovered that they had had their doubts about Wennerström for years. He was too boastful, and he put on airs. During the following weeks, as Millennium's documentation was scrutinized, pulled apart, and pieced together again, the Wennerström empire of obscure companies was linked to the heart of the international mafia, including everything from illegal arms dealing and money laundering for South American drug cartels to prostitution in New York, and even indirectly to the child sex trade in Mexico. One Wennerström company registered in Cyprus caused a dramatic stir when it was revealed that it had attempted to buy enriched uranium on the black market in Ukraine. Wennerström's apparently inexhaustible supply of obscure post office box companies seemed to be cropping up everywhere, linked to all manner of shady enterprises. Berger thought that the book was the best thing Blomqvist had ever written. It was uneven, stylistically, and in places the writing was actually rather poor. There had been no time for any fine polishing, but the book was animated by a fury that no reader could help but notice. By chance, Blomqvist ran into his old adversary, the former financial reporter William Borg, in front of Kvarnen when Blomqvist, Berger and Malm took the evening off to celebrate the Santa Lucia holiday along with the magazine's other employees, going out to drink themselves senseless at the company's expense. Borg's companion was a very drunk girl, about Salander's age. Blomqvist's loathing for Borg was palpable. Berger interrupted the macho posturing by taking Blomqvist by the arm and leading him into the bar. Blomqvist decided that when the opportunity arose, he would ask Salander to do one of her personal investigations of Borg, just for form's sake. During the whole media storm, the main character in the drama, the financier Wennerström, was for the most part invisible. On the day that Millennium published its article, the financier was forced to comment on the text at a press conference that had been called for a different purpose. He declared the allegations unfounded and said that the documentation referred to was fabricated. He reminded everyone that the same reporter had been convicted of libel only 1 year before. After that, only Wennerström's lawyers would answer questions from the media. 2 days after Blomqvist's book came out, a persistent rumour began circulating that Wennerström had left Sweden. The evening papers used the word fled. During the second week, when the securities fraud police tried to contact Wennerström, he was nowhere to be found. In mid-December, the police confirmed that Wennerström was formally sought, and on the day before New Year's Eve, an all-points bulletin was sent out via the international police organisations. The very same day, one of Wennerström's advisers was seized at Arlanda as he was boarding a plane for London. Several weeks later, a Swedish tourist reported that he had seen Wennerström get into a car in Bridgetown, the capital of Barbados. As proof of his claim, the tourist submitted a photograph, taken from quite a distance away, showing a white man wearing sunglasses, an open white shirt, and light-coloured slacks. He could not be identified with certainty, but the evening papers contacted stringers who tried without success to track down the fugitive billionaire. After 6 months, the hunt was called off. Then Wennerström was found dead in an apartment in Marbella, Spain, where he had been living under the name of Victor Fleming. He had been shot 3 times in the head, at close range. The Spanish police were working on the theory, their statement said, that he had surprised a burglar. Wennerström's death came as no surprise to Salander. She suspected with good reason that his demise had to do with the fact that he no longer had access to the money in a certain bank in the Cayman Islands, which he may have needed to pay off certain debts in Colombia. If anyone had asked for Salander's help in tracking Wennerström, she could have told them almost on a daily basis where he was.
Via the internet, she had followed his flight through a dozen countries and remarked a growing desperation in his emails. Not even Blomqvist would have thought that the fugitive ex-billionaire would be stupid enough to take along the computer that had been so thoroughly penetrated. After 6 months, Salander grew tired of tracking Venestrom. The question that remained to be answered was how far her own involvement should reach. Venestrom was without a doubt an Olympic-class creep, but he was not her personal enemy, and she had no interest in involving herself against him. She could tip off Blomqvist, but he would probably just publish a story. She could tip off the police, but there was quite a chance that Venestrom would be forewarned and again disappear. Besides, on principle, she did not talk to the police. But there were other debts that had to be paid. She thought about the once pregnant waitress whose head had been shoved underwater in her own bath. 4 days before Venestrom's body was found, she made up her mind. She switched on her mobile and called a lawyer in Miami, who seemed to be one of the people Venestrom was making a big effort to hide from. She talked to a secretary and asked her to pass on a cryptic message, the name Venestrom and an address in Marbella. That was all. She turned off the TV news halfway through a dramatic report about Venestrom's demise. She put on some coffee and fixed herself a liver pate and cucumber sandwich. Berger and Mom were taking care of the annual Christmas arrangements while Blomqvist sat in Erika's chair drinking glug and looking on. All the staff and many of the regular freelancers would receive a Christmas gift, this year a shoulder bag with the new Millennium Publishing House logo. After wrapping the presents, they sat down to write and stamp about 200 cards to send to printing companies, photographers, and media colleagues. Blomqvist tried for the longest time to withstand the temptation, but finally he couldn't resist. He picked up the very last card and wrote, "Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. Thanks for your splendid efforts during the past year." He signed his name and addressed the card to Jana Dahlman, care of the editorial offices of Monopoly Financial magazine. When Blomqvist got home that evening, there was a slip notifying him of a postal package. He went to pick it up the next morning, opening it when he got to the office. The package contained a mosquito-repellent stick and a bottle of Rimus Holmes Aquavit. The card read, "If you don't have other plans, I'll be Dr. Arholma on Midsummer Eve." It was signed Robert Lindberg. Traditionally, the Millennium offices were closed the week before Christmas and through the New Year's holiday. This year it did not work out that way. The strain on the small staff had been enormous, and journalists were still calling from all over the world on a daily basis. It was the day before Christmas Eve when Blomqvist, almost by chance, happened to read an article in the Financial Times summing up the findings of the International Banking Commission that had been established in all haste to scrutinise the collapse of the Venestrom Empire. The article said that the commission was working on the hypothesis that Venestrom had probably been tipped off at the last minute about the impending disclosures. His account at Bank of Kronenfeld in the Cayman Islands containing $260 million, approximately 2.5 billion Swedish kronor, had been emptied the day before Millennium published its exposé. The money had been spread over a number of accounts, and only Venestrom personally could make withdrawals. He did not have to be present at the bank. It was enough for him to present a series of clearing codes in order to transfer the money to any bank in the world. The money had been transferred to Switzerland, where a female associate had converted the funds into anonymous private bonds. All the clearing codes were in order. Europol had launched a search for the woman who had used a stolen British passport in the name of Monica Scholes and who was said to have lived a life of luxury at one of Zurich's most expensive hotels. A relatively clear picture, considering that it came from a surveillance camera, showed a short woman with a blonde page boy, wide lips and prominent breasts, wearing fashionable designer clothes and gold jewellery. Blomqvist studied the picture, giving it first a quick glance and then looking at it with increasing suspicion. After several seconds, he rummaged in his desk for a magnifying glass and tried to make out the details of the facial features in the newspaper's screened image. At last he put down the paper and sat there, speechless, for several minutes. Then he started laughing so hysterically that Malm stuck his head round the door to find out what was going on. On the morning of Christmas Eve, Blomqvist went out to Orsta to see his ex-wife and his daughter Pernilla
and exchange gifts. Pernilla got the computer she wanted, which Blomqvist and Monica had bought together. Blomqvist got a tie from Monica and a detective novel by Åke Edvardsson from his daughter. Unlike the previous Christmas, they were in high spirits because of the media drama that had been playing out around Millennium. They had lunch together. Blomqvist stole a sidelong glance at Pernilla. He had not seen his daughter since she turned up to visit him in Hedstad. He realized that he had failed to discuss her mania for that sect in Skellefteå with her mother. He could not tell them that it was his daughter's obviously profound knowledge of the Bible that had set him on the right track regarding Harriet Vanger's disappearance. He had not talked to his daughter since then. He was not a good father. He kissed his daughter goodbye after the lunch and met Salander at Slussen. They went out to Sandhamn. They had not seen much of each other since the Millennium Bomb exploded. They arrived late on Christmas Eve and stayed for the holidays. Blomqvist was entertaining company, as always, but Salander had an uneasy feeling that he was looking at her with an especially odd expression when she paid back the loan with a cheque for 120,000 kroner. They took a walk to Trovill and back, which Salander considered a waste of time, had Christmas dinner at the inn and went back to the cabin where they lit a fire in the wood stove, put on an Elvis CD, and devoted themselves to some plain old sex. When Salander from time to time came up for air, she tried to analyze her feelings. She had no problem with Blomqvist as a lover. There was obviously a physical attraction, and he never tried to tutor her. Her problem was that she could not interpret her own feelings for him. Not since before reaching puberty had she lowered her guard to let another person get so close as she had with him. To be quite honest, he had a trying ability to penetrate her defences and to get her to talk about personal matters and private feelings. Even though she had enough sense to ignore most of his questions, she talked about herself in a way that she would never, even under threat of death, have imagined doing with any other person. It frightened her and made her feel naked and vulnerable to his will. At the same time, when she looked down at his slumbering form and listened to him snoring, she felt that she had never before in her life had such a trust in another human being. She knew with absolute certainty that Mikhail would never use what he knew about her to hurt her. It was not in his nature. The only thing they never discussed was their relationship to each other. She did not dare, and Blomqvist never broached the subject. At some point on the morning of the second day, she came to a terrifying realization. She had no idea how it had happened or how she was supposed to cope with it. She was in love for the first time in her life. That he was almost twice her age did not bother her, nor did the fact that at the moment he was one of the most newsworthy people in Sweden and his picture was even on the cover of Newsweek. That was all just soap opera. But Blomqvist was no erotic fantasy or daydream. It would have to come to an end. It could not possibly work out. What did he need her for? Maybe she was just a way to pass the time while he waited for someone whose life was not a fucking rat hole. What she had realized was that love was that moment when your heart was about to burst. When Blomqvist woke up late that morning, she had made coffee and been out to buy breakfast rolls. He joined her at the table and noticed at once that something in her attitude had changed. She was a bit more reserved. When he asked her if anything was wrong, she gave him a neutral, uncomprehending look. On the first day between Christmas and New Year's, Blomqvist took the train up to Hedestad. He was wearing his warmest clothes and his proper winter shoes when Frodo met him at the station and quietly congratulated him on the media success. It was the first time since August that he had visited Hedestad, and it was almost exactly 1 year ago since he had visited it for the first time. They chatted politely, but there was also a great deal that had gone unsaid between them, and Blomqvist felt uncomfortable. Everything had been prepared, and the business with Frodo took only a few minutes. Frodo offered to deposit the money in a convenient foreign bank account, but Blomqvist insisted that it should be paid like a normal, legitimate fee to his company. "I can't afford any other type of payment," he said curtly when Frodo persisted. The purpose of his visit was not solely financial. Blomqvist had left clothes, books, and a number of his own things in the cottage when he and Salander had abandoned Hedeby in great haste. Vanger was still frail after his illness, but he was at home. He was being looked after by a private nurse,
who refused to allow him to take long walks or walk upstairs or discuss anything that might upset him. During the holidays, he had also come down with a slight cold and was ordered to bed.
"Besides which, she's expensive," Wanger complained.
Blomqvist knew that the old man could afford any such expense, considering how many kroner he had written off his taxes all his life. Wanger gave him a sullen look, until he started laughing.
"What the hell? You were worth every kroner. I knew you would be."
"To tell you the truth, I never thought I'd solve it."
"I have no intention of thanking you," Wanger said.
"I didn't expect you would. I'm just here to tell you that I consider the job done."
Wanger curled his lips.
"You haven't finished the job," he said.
"I know that."
"You haven't written the Wanger Family Chronicle, which was agreed."
"I know that. I'm not going to write it. In fact, I can't write it. I can't write about the Wanger family and leave out the most central event of the past decades. How could I write a chapter about Martin's period as CEO and pretend that I don't know what's in his basement? I also can't write the story without destroying Harriet's life all over again."
"I understand your dilemma, and I'm grateful for the decision that you've made."
"Congratulations. You've managed to corrupt me. I'm going to destroy all my notes and the tape recordings I've made of our conversations."
"I don't think that you've been corrupted," Wanger said.
"That's what it feels like, and I think that's what it is."
"You had to choose between your role as a journalist and your role as a human being. I could never have bought your silence, and I'm quite certain that you would have exposed us if Harriet had turned out in some way to have been implicated, or if you thought I was a cretin."
Blomqvist did not reply.
"We've told Cecilia the whole story. Froda and I will soon be gone, and Harriet is going to need support from someone in the family. Cecilia will play an active role on the board. She and Harriet will be in charge of the firm from now on."
"How did she take it?"
"She was very shaken. She went abroad for a while. I was even afraid she wouldn't come back."
"But she did."
"Martin was one of the few people in our family that Cecilia always got along with. It was very hard for her to find out the truth about him. She also knows now what you did for the family."
Blomqvist shrugged.
"So thank you, Mikael,"
Wanger said.
"Besides, I couldn't write the story because I've had it up to here with the Wanger family. But tell me, how does it feel to be CEO again?"
"It's only temporary, but I wish I were younger. I'm only working 3 hours a day. All the meetings are held in this room, and Dirk has stepped in again as my enforcer if anyone acts up."
"The junior executives must be quaking in their boots."
"It took me a while to realise that Dirk wasn't just an old sweetie of a financial advisor, but also someone who solves problems for you."
"Exactly. But all decisions are made with Harriet, and she's the one who's doing the legwork in the office."
"How are things going for her?"
"She inherited both her brother's and her mother's shares. She controls about 33% of the corporation."
"Is that enough?"
"I don't know. Birger is trying to trip her up. Alexander has seen that he has a chance to make an impact and has allied himself with Birger. My brother Harold has cancer and won't live much longer. He was the only remaining person with large shareholdings of 7%, which his children will inherit. Cecilia and Anita will be on Harriet's side."
"Then together you'll control, what, 45%?
"That kind of voting cartel has never existed within the family before. Plenty of shareholders with 1% and 2% will vote against us. Harriet is going to succeed me as CEO in February."
"That won't make her happy."
"No, but it's necessary. We have to take in some new partners and new blood. We also have the chance to collaborate with her company in Australia. There are possibilities."
"Where's Harriet today?"
"You're out of luck. She's in London. But she would very much like to see you."
"I'll see her at our board meeting in January if she's going to take your place."
"I know."
"I think that she realises that I will never discuss what happened in the 60s with anyone except for Erika Berger. And I don't see why Erika needs to know."
"She does. You're a person with morals, Mikael."
but also tell her that everything she does from now on could end up in the magazine. The Wanger Corporation won't have a free pass from scrutiny.
I'll warn her.
Blomqvist left Wanger when he started to doze off. He packed his belongings into two suitcases. As he closed the door to the cottage for the last time, he paused and then went over to Cecilia's house and knocked. She was not at home. He took out his pocket calendar, tore out a page and wrote, "I wish you all the best. Try to forgive me. Mikhail." He put the note in her letterbox. An electric Christmas candle shone in the kitchen window of Martin Wanger's empty house. He took the last train back to Stockholm. During the holidays, Salander tuned out the rest of the world. She did not answer her telephone and she did not turn on her computer. She spent 2 days washing laundry, scrubbing and cleaning up her apartment. Year-old pizza boxes and newspapers were bundled up and carried downstairs. She dragged out a total of 6 black rubbish bags and 20 paper bags full of newspapers. She felt as if she had decided to start a new life. She thought about buying a new apartment when she found something suitable. But for now her old place would be more dazzlingly clean than she could ever remember. Then she sat as if paralyzed, thinking. She had never in her life felt such a longing. She wanted Mikhail Blomqvist to ring the doorbell and, what then? Lift her off the ground, hold her in his arms, passionately take her into the bedroom and tear off her clothes? No, she really just wanted his company. She wanted to hear him say that he liked her for who she was, that she was someone special in his world and in his life. She wanted him to give her some gesture of love, not just of friendship and companionship. "I'm flipping out," she thought. She had no faith in herself. Blomqvist lived in a world populated by people with respectable jobs, people with orderly lives and lots of grown-up points. His friends did things, went on TV and shaped the headlines. "What do you need me for?" Salander's greatest fear, which was so huge and so black that it was of phobic proportions, was that people would laugh at her feelings. And all of a sudden, all her carefully constructed self-confidence seemed to crumble. That's when she made up her mind. It took her several hours to mobilize the necessary courage, but she had to see him and tell him how she felt. Anything else would be unbearable. She needed some excuse to knock on his door. She had not given him any Christmas present, but she knew what she was going to buy. In a junk shop, she had seen a number of metal advertising signs from the 50s with embossed images. One of the signs showed Elvis Presley with a guitar on his hip and a cartoon balloon with the words Heartbreak Hotel. She had no sense for interior design, but even she could tell that the sign would be perfect for the cabin in Sandhamn. It cost 780 kroner. And on principle she haggled and got the price knocked down to 700. She had it wrapped, put it under her arm, and headed over to his place on Bellmansgarten. At Hornsgarten she happened to glance towards Café Bar and saw Blomqvist coming out with Berger in tow. He said something and she laughed, putting her arm around his waist and kissing his cheek. They turned down Brennkirkegarten in the direction of Bellmansgarten. Their body language left no room for misinterpretations. It was obvious what they had in mind. The pain was so immediate and so fierce that Lisbeth stopped in mid-stride, incapable of movement. Part of her wanted to rush after them. She wanted to take the metal sign and use the sharp edge to cleave Berger's head in two. She did nothing, as thoughts swirled through her mind. Analysis of consequences. Finally, she calmed down.
"What a pathetic fool you are, Salander," she said out loud.
She turned on her heel and went home to her newly spotless apartment. As she passed Zinkensdamm, it started to snow. She tossed Elvis into a dumpster. This is Simon Vance. We hope you've enjoyed this production of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo by Stieg Larsson. Published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Inc. Text copyright 2005 by Norstedts Agency. English translation copyright 2008 by Reg Keeland.
Production copyright 2008, Books on Tape.